With that, I'm going to go ahead and just wrap things up because I'm really excited. Again, I'm going to bring Jeff on, and I've already told you kind of like my personal experience, but I want you to realize that Jeff Lawton has been doing this stuff heavily since 1983. That's a long time. He's worked all over the world with permaculture. He is the head of the Permaculture Research Institute in Australia, and he does an amazing job there. But he travels all over the place, to the Middle East, to Central and South America. You name it, he's done that. He's been there, and his results speak for themselves. He is an absolute pioneer in permaculture, a wonderful teacher, and one of what I consider my remote mentors, somebody that I've been learning from a long time, for a very long time. And like I said, it is really an honor to have him on the show today. And with that, hey, Jeff, welcome to the Survival Podcast, man.
Oh, thank you. Good to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you on, and my audience knows exactly who you are because I've been talking about you for a long time, and we talk a lot about permaculture here. But a lot of, this is kind of like a different kind of question to get started with. A lot of people out there don't know about permaculture and maybe don't know who you are. So when you meet someone who has no idea about who you are and what you do, and they have the common question, you know, what do you do for a living? How do you answer that?
Almost every time the first word to a permaculture question is "it depends," so it will depend on who's asking the question. And I very much like to say to a lot of people that I'm actually a farmer because that's what I love to do. I love to work on the land, but I'm a managing director of the Permaculture Research Institute. I'm also a consultant and designer. So the Permaculture Research Institute is a non-profit organization that teaches permaculture and demonstrates permaculture demonstration sites and sets them up around the world. As a designer and a consultant, I literally do that. I design and consult for people. And the next question is usually, well, what is permaculture? And it's a system of design for sustainable living where humanity can provide all its needs in a way that's beneficial to the environment itself. And if I don't get a blank face, then I pull up. But otherwise, I might have to go into a little bit of a sort of teaching explanation and carefully sort of carve that explanation out in relation to who's asking the question. And I think you have to be sort of a little bit... bit of a diplomat and a bit of a navigator to make sure that it's taken the right way, and because it is a bit emotional what's happening worldwide, and when people get emotional, then we lose a bit of clarity, and sometimes we can make a few mistakes there. So we just make sure that we can sort of be careful about how we explain things and just say it's not something too wild or it's not something too organized. It's something that's quite organic, but it's got good track record now and it's working.
For me, I've explained it to a lot of people is in many ways it's almost a system of troubleshooting. So we can go into a piece of property and look at it and see all the things that we don't like about how things are working and use this organized approach to design the land to get what we want out of it without doing further damage and without harming things around it.
Yeah, it's a great methodology for repairing the landscape, even on the broadest of scales, even on the scale of the lowest plateau, where, 35,000 square kilometers were repaired in China, the most degraded ecosystem on the planet, right down to a little balcony. It's really a wonderful common sense methodology of design. On the other end of the scale, it's probably an evolution in thinking, and what we do is translate the language of permaculture into an approach to that evolution of thinking that may be an evolution of humanity, I think, hopefully.
Yeah, I completely agree. When you look at permaculture today, what do you think we need to do to get more mainstream extreme acceptance of it? I think that we're a lot further along than we were 10 years ago. But I still think we have a long way to go. What is it that you find that really wins people over to the concept?
Well, we're producing practitioners at an extremely fast rate, and they're moving into service, they're moving into action very fast. now. We're producing teachers as well, and the number of teachers are increasing, which is great. I encourage people to teach all the time. We really need more teachers. Designers and consultants are also coming up fast. It may be a little bit more awkward to design and consult for people. It's always the people systems that are hard. It's always the complication of people. We are complicated. Obviously, that's how we, you know, we've done what we've done and we can do what we can do in the positive. And then the ultimate is we need people who can set up institutes, like that set up the teaching venues, set up the institutes. And that now is a commercial reality, an aid reality, and an obligation that we have to produce instigators of institutes.
Yeah, and I'll tell you one of the things I really admire about you, Jeff. There's a lot of people that have, let's say, your level of recognition, not necessarily in permaculture, but in whatever it is that they do. As a teacher, and they seem to want to like stay like the teacher or the expert, and you seem to have this huge desire to create as many teachers as you can, and if they can teach better than you, so much the better.
Yeah, but there may be a flip side to that, and that means you have to keep teaching because you become popular with it. Maybe that's the best advertiser of a teacher ever, I don't know. yeah, I'd really like to be redundant so I could just stay and farm and live my life at a sort of normal level, but I feel obliged to keep helping people get going. And I'm teaching right as now, I'm teaching a permaculture teacher's course inside an internship at the moment. It's also open to the public. And we're on second day today. And it's an interesting exercise teaching people what it is that you actually do as a teacher. You don't really teach them that much in information. You cover the basics of the curricula, but a real teacher lights a fire of passion in people. And if you're a really good teacher, you infect people with permaculture and it's terminal. There's no recovery.
Yeah, I've seen that happen to a lot of people, and I think it's probably the best infection a person can get. One of the things I think that would make permaculture far more accepted and used is if we can help people see that it can be profitable. There seems to be this mindset in agriculture, which says that, you know, there's this way to make money, and then there's this way to be natural, you know, friendly to nature, and that the two are somehow, you know, disassociated with each other. My experience is that permaculture systems create tremendous abundance and tremendous opportunity for farmers to be profitable if they'll use these systems. But how can we help farmers make that transition, like when they're stuck in this modern system and they want to move over? What are some steps they can take to kind of pay the bills while the system takes over?
Well, unfortunately, because we've been so clever with our technological advances and the advantage of fossilized sunlight resources, and we've exploited those. It's like the Jevons Providine, that when we keep providing something, it keeps getting used up. The advantage we've gained in technology has sort of coming close to an exploited finite endpoints. We can see those, and the ecology of Earth is the one resource we can extend, and we're just starting to realize that we can extend the ecology further than ever imagined, probably hundreds of thousands or millions of times more resourceful in its living resources. And everything that we use at present comes from an original ecology of some sort. So the resources, the source of the resources, are living systems, and the only systems we can extend and enhance and improve everything as we do. So what we're using are derivatives, and we don't put we don't put an importance on the source, which is always originally the, you know, the sunlight and the living systems of Earth. And there's nothing green about that. That's just straightforward chemical science, if you like. So any other industry, if we're looking at straight industries, we don't put the derivatives in front of the source of the derivatives. Everything derives from the ecosystems in reality. So I think we're coming to a point in the information age where we're going to realize this. And I think it is actually starting to happen. Hopefully we get to a tipping point reasonably quickly before there's too much of a crash. And we better get ready for that crash, of course, and put a lot of airbags in the car or the truck, because it's a bit of a juggernaut that we're charging along here in. But it's a matter of actually valuing the source element. And a green economy, and let's not think of that as sort of woo-woo or hippie too much. It's about money, of course. It's about economy. It's about exchange in convenient ways. But that ecological economy is bigger and has more exchange and finance and money and employment and meaningful existence in it than the production and consumption economy we've presently driven to the point of our own extinction. We've been exploitive rather than creative around that thinking. And I think there is a switch happening. And I think it will come from the business community. I think it will come from the people who are presently actually in power and the people who have still some sort of controls in ways that I don't think there's, you know, it's all that many bad people out there, really. It there obviously are, but most people are, you know, coming to us and realizing that there's a big change. There's a really big change happening. We're working for governments. We're working for kingdoms. We're working for large corporations who are seeing this change around. And it's definitely an economy that is going to grow beyond our imagination. So I don't think there's a problem there. Actually, I can imagine people investing very soon in setting up institutes as demonstration sites and education centers because they are economic, because they are a good business. And I'm trying to get ready to facilitate that action, because I can see it coming. It's on the horizon, not that far away.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about you, but when I first really learned about permaculture, when I first thought I learned about permaculture, I thought permaculture was I plant a tree instead of a corn plant. And then I actually learned about the entire system of design, started getting turned on to Bill's earlier work, your work, things like that. And once I did, and I got an understanding of things like earthworks and edges and zones and layers and all this stuff, I'd drive down the road and I'd go, look at all of this wasted space. Look how we've made the water go away instead of stay. Look at what we could do there. Look at this corporate campus and how much food could be grown instead of grass. Did you have that same kind of experience when you first kind of entered this world?
Yeah, I mean, you can't switch it off. And you kind of forget. You look back that far. I mean, 1980 when I first got involved, and 1983 when I took my course with Bill. But I have students come to me. I had a student come to me and say, "You've ruined my view of the countryside." So good. It needs to be ruined. You need to get it right. And don't go out there and plant a tree. Plant an ecosystem. And we like to try and shock people a little bit out of their reality zone, you know, like, you know, don't plant trees, you know, and people look and they're shocked. What do you mean, don't plant trees? You're supposed to be green and all this. No, plant ecosystems that, you know, become stable, you know, guilds of trees and plants that can extend themselves. They have some integrity, you know. Think about it. You know, it's not just about straight lines and, you know, plant something that has a natural matrix of stability and get out of that box a bit, you know. And so I think people like that. They're excited about all the possibilities.
Yeah, I do too. I get a lot of questions about earthwork stuff. And one of the things I've talked about a lot on the show is reducing irrigation requirements or even eliminating it using swales and contour paths and things like that. And I've honestly answered this question. I'm hoping that when it comes from you, people will stop asking it, honestly. But I get a tremendous number of people saying, well, I can't do swales because my land is absolutely flat, or I'm in a sandy environment or something like that. So can you talk a little bit about how, you know, kind of how that works out, how swales and contour paths can work in areas that maybe people don't get their head around right away?
Did you say contour paths?
Yes, like in between like raised beds.
Oh, wonderful. It's so nice to hear you use that terminology.
Well, I learned it from you, so I'm not going to claim credit for it. That's your term.
Okay, yeah, it's sort of swale thinking on footpaths in between raised beds.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look, people get a little bit afraid about the large machinery because it kind of looks like some kind of war machine, like a tank. A bulldozer literally is a tank with a blade on the front, nearly. But it's all a matter of scale. One of the great lessons of permaculture, pattern understanding, chapter 4 in Bill's book, The Designer's Manual, is about understanding scale as well as the physical patterns. And the scale of a bulldozer and this machinery is it only looks big in relation to a human's physical size. In relation to the planet, it's not very big at all. A brain surgeon working on your scalp with a scalpel or even laser surgery is much, much bigger than the biggest bulldozer on this planet working on the surface of the Earth. It is nanosurgery, even using a 120-ton D12 bulldozer. Comparatively to brain surgery, it's nanosurgery. And what we're doing is reconstructive earth surgery. And the wonderful men who drive these machines can be real artists and creative workers, just like sculptors. They can use those machines very, very creatively. And they understand water because they haven't dealt with levels and water all the time. So they're geosurgeons. And we could train armies and armies and armies of people. We could put all the bulldozers into service, all the machinery into service to repair this planet. And within less than a decade, it would be a completely different place. And I wish some of the large earth-moving companies would realize that, because they could do with some research and development about how we could build, apply these machines and design machines that could do this even better and quicker, because they have that ability still. But the general person doesn't understand some basic things. The flatter the land, and that we are not on flat land. Unless you're on a salt pan, there is no perfectly flat land. And a salt pan is a dried up lake. So if you're on slightly sloping land, very, very flat land in appearance, you have the ability to harvest more water because you just put a 1 meter earth bank up, or a 3 feet high earth bank, and you're holding back hundreds of feet of water or hundreds of meters of water because it holds so much more water behind the earth bank, behind the swale bank. Whenever you dig a hole, you end up with surplus material. So when you're building a dam, you end up with all these creative opportunities of spare soils and subsoils that you can create earth banks. And when you're in flat country, you also have a lot of problems with stress on the landscape because there's no wind breaking. So wind is often a stressful element. So every time you come up with a problem, there's a creative solution. And usually the bigger the problem, the bigger the creative solution. And that's kind of like an oxymoron. It doesn't seem to make sense. And I remember when I did my course with Bill in 83, and he said, you know, the more problems we have, the more restrictions you have on a design, the more creative you will end up in the design phase, and the design will end up more of a creative event. And I thought, how does that work? That doesn't make sense. I mean, I'm trained as an engineer originally, a mechanical engineer, so I have a mechanical way of thinking about things, and that just seemed to be a ridiculous thing to say. It just was back to front. But then actually when you get out there and you start working, you realize that that's absolutely true. And this funny saying that we have in permaculture, the problem is the solution, forces one to be more creative. And it's kind of like the Einstein statement that, you know, there's more interesting things out of the box than there is in the box we're presently in. And if you stay within the box, you stay within that paradigm of thinking. When you step outside, all this creativity comes out. And of course, we govern our actions by functionality. So we look at every placement of every element. We rationalize, we legitimize to people, and we try and position it so it has more than one function. So multifunctionality, rationalization, legitimization of placement. It becomes this explorative design mind that you develop. And I think the young men that I'm seeing coming through our courses here, they're going to be incredible. What they can do, we'll be able to design in the next 20 to 30 years. At this present moment, we couldn't even imagine it.
Yeah, and I mean, the one thing I want to make sure that people kind of glean from what you said there is that even when you think it's flat, it's not flat, and there are contours there to be worked with. Because you had contours in your Greening the Desert project, right? I mean, that's about as flat looking as it gets, but yet you had contours to work with.
Oh yeah. The surveying of flat land is more difficult because the levels are subtle. Now here's an example. That land was 10 acres in size, and it was only at a 4 foot fall over the whole 10 acres at a diagonal. So it was quite a small fall. But on flat land like that, you can move slightly up and downhill in the line of a swale. In other words, you can go off contour, up or downhill, because on the horizontal, you only go up and down a few inches. So you just make the swale trench deeper or shallower to avoid an obstacle, or to connect to something of value, or to put shape and form around infrastructure, or for whatever reason, you end up with a creative license because of the subtlety of the landscape. Now, you can't do that on hill country, because if you move sideways, going uphill, all of a sudden you've gone up too quickly and you've gone down too quickly downhill. You can't vary the line. Hardly at all, if at all. The steeper it gets, the more restrictive it is on your potential creativity of varying contour, because you can't adjust the depth. So flat country is more creative in its comparative design end result. It stands out. It completely stands out in flat country. What the hell have you done over there? There's a huge oasis. Where the hill country, you're harmonizing with the landscape forms more precisely, because you have to. And that's all we're actually doing a lot of the time. And we are harmonizing with the cosmic energies that created and formed the landscape in the first place. And that's not a cosmic statement. That's an actual fact.
sure, absolutely. Yeah, on the contour lines, I mean, I've kind of put it that the contours are there whether we choose to work with them or not. And if we choose not to work with them, they're going to show us just how apparently they really are there. And it basically will get erosion and damage to anything we try to put in place. When we work with them, it's kind of like a sculptor that says, okay, the sculpture was in the block of marble before I chipped it away. I just revealed it. And I was going to ask you, kind of, because I've noticed this as I've started to do a lot of work on land that already has some regrowth on it, that there's a lot of growth that naturally occurs on existing contour line that we've never touched.
Yeah, there are specific points in landscape, particularly the point of inflection at the top of a valley, the key point where the valley goes from convex to concave, where you get a lot of regrowth, because that is the first point at the top of the valley where water slows. As soon as water slows, not only do you get accumulated hydrology and dampness, but you also get residual material, which is often extra minerals and organic fertilizers or organic materials accumulated. So you'll get these points, and wherever we slow water, we gather materials as well, and that is a constant. So there are many constants to look for out there that we can design to. Water only moves at right angle to contour is a constant. And when it slows, when you slow water or you slow air, you drop the materials that the water or air is carrying for its velocity at that time. These are constants. So there are lots of little constants out there that we can anchor to as designers. And water is such a major element of life. Water and carbon are the two major elements. And as we design these systems, what we're doing is we're slowing the energy loss of the system. In other words, we are extending the entropy. Entropy being the energy that is lost out of systems. Einstein was quoted as saying, energy is constant in the universe. It just transfers from one element to another, one system to another. Entropy is constantly increasing. He's remembered for the energy statement, but not so much the entropy statement. The entropy is a very important part of what we're doing. So we are designers of long-term energy storage, which then can be put to use. And water is an amazing energy, and it's never the amount of water you have that's important. It's the amount of times you use that water, the number of times you put it to use. If you only have, you know, 10 gallons of water, you use it once, that's all you have. If you use it 10 times, it's like you have 100 gallons of water.
There's some interesting things I've seen you explain that can be done with water to kind of take that entropy, and just when it's about, you've just about done everything you can, and it's about to fall off the end and go down to the next property that you don't have control over, how you can rebound it. Like one thing I saw that you said you could do is plant like a pond down at the bottom and plant reeds in that pond, and that fertility on the land ends up in that pond, so it ends up in the reeds. And now if we simply cut those reeds once in a while, take them to the top of the property, we haven't rebounded the water at that point, but we've used the water's properties to rebound the fertility. Are there some other things like that you could maybe talk about?
Yeah, we're setting up little energy traps and soaks and sponges. And carbon is the great sponge on the planet. So if you continuously think of it as your sponge, you know, your high nitrogen manures will bond up in carbon, and that's how your compost actually works. And you're slowing down the leach point by bonding to carbon. The reeds bond the mobile elements in the water, the suspended nutrient in the water and sediments in the water, and they bond it in their bodies, linking it to carbons in that life process. That's how the giant swamps in the Mississippi work at the bottom of your great river there in North America. The cypress swamps are giant sponges and are really America's greatest asset. And there's a wonderful repair job that needs to be done to put that into function in a greater form. So you can look at the macrocosm or the microcosm to learn about the this universe and this reality. It's the edges that are interesting. So if you look right to the outside edges of everything, you can see things much clearer than trying to look at the hole in the middle. I talk to a lot of people about edge thinking. So your edge of your systems, from the top where the energy is highest but the life is lowest, to the bottom where the energy is lowest but the life is highest. And there you can pull some of that back. You're designing your system so you can pull back from the bottom and redistribute higher up in the system, so it takes another cycle. You can never get it all, though. We can never get everything, but we sure can improve on what we're doing. In fact, I don't think we could do a worse job than what we're doing. I think we have to try very hard.
Yeah, I can agree, because like, you start talking about what a great asset the swamps are, and immediately I think about how if they're not protected swamps, the first thing people do with them is drain them. And it drives me absolutely bonkers. Switching up though a little bit, I've got a ton of people that listen that don't have, you know, the 4 or 5, 10 acres, 20 acres. They have the suburban lots. And, when you said the more restrictions you place, the more you can actually do with design, if you're creative, I don't think there's a better example than your urban permaculture DVD, which, by the way, was absolutely fabulous. But what I get from people all the time are, what are some things I can do with smaller pieces of land? And I know the typical answer is you do whatever you like if you follow the rules and what have you. But are there some things that maybe you've learned over the years that are like the biggest, like bang for the buck, either plantings or earthworks, like specific plants or specific things that people can shape their land with on those small tenth to half acre suburban lots?
Yeah, micro earthworks work fine. The thing is with small space is that it's so productive per square meter, more productive or per square foot, more productive than any other land per area on Earth, because you have that, you know, you have that much energy and attention over the area, and in suburbs particularly, you have so much microclimate with thermal mass of buildings and hardware and runoff from roads. So you can create this micro-enhanced landscape, and your design options are much higher. So you can go into very high-value crop. You can go into very high-value elements. It's not an area to waste on main crop systems like, you know, standard carbohydrate crops are kind of wasted really in suburbs. I mean, we can do all that on the larger area just outside of human settlements. But I think eventually we'll have extremely high value, rare and quite difficult to produce elements within cities, within small spaces. Almost like the future pharmaceuticals of the world, the future medical system production, and the highly specialized mineral accumulators eventually will be the production elements there. And everything more or less cycling from the wastes of humanity, that which are, we naturally have certain waste systems and packaging systems, and we always have wastewater because we use it always, you know, where there's people there has to be water. But then we have crop residues from the larger crops in the perimeter, and it's a very interesting and pleasant place when you look at it redesigned. But it's one hell of a contract to redesign. But there's a lot of it's going to have to be done, and I think that in itself is going to be very exciting for some people because that's what they specialize in and that's what they're interested in.
Yeah, I've always tried to tell people the stuff that you can't easily buy, and a lot of times that's the stuff that's really good but doesn't store well or doesn't ship well. It's ideal to grow in those urban environments because that way it can go from the field to the plate in minutes. So there is no shipping, and I think there's a lot of stuff that, you know, is kind of like that. Nanking cherry, for instance, they're a great fruit, but they leak and they don't really ship or store well, but we can grow those in small spaces in a backyard.
Yeah, yeah. Now, unfortunately, the supermarkets don't sell a lot of the crops that would be ideal for where the supermarket is. And they're not likely to tell you to do this either, because they'd feel like they were putting themselves out of business. They probably wouldn't be. It would probably be quite the reverse. I think the ultimate diet of humanity would be from a recipe book that always had a place and a date on it. So every recipe would have the place and the month of the year, and then everything that was in every recipe would be producible at that site or very close by. And if we then, if that was the product, if that was the advertising theme of the seller of food, then you would know you were buying everything from local. It would be zero food miles and zero food time and zero food guilt. I think that's the ultimate food franchise, actually. And I don't think we are at the end of understanding everything that will grow everywhere. We're still collecting food plants of the world. In fact, the desert food plant collection is not really been done very much at all. Being permaculture people, we naturally lean towards diversity because we realize it is the interactivity of diversity that gives us those stable productive ecosystems that we're famous for all. So we're always collectors of plants. I grow all sorts of things on the site where I am here in Australia that are quite expensive in the shops, in the health food shops and in the supermarkets even. And they're rampant. They're no problem. I don't even find them. I almost have to slow them down.
Yeah. I just read an article you wrote a couple years ago on a plant I had never heard of before called salad mallow. And you said that it really we need to look at it as a crop of importance, almost like a main crop. And that was a couple of years ago. How did your work with that plant go? And are there? And I love new things. Like as soon as I read that, I found one place I could get seeds shipped to the United States from, and it was in the UK, and it was like $12 for shipping to get this little packet of seeds sent over. But I was happy to pay it. How'd that work? And are there any other like things like that that we can grow that people don't think of specifically because I love your DVDs, but you know, like this is a tree tomato that doesn't grow in temperate climates or doesn't live anyway through the first season. Any other thing that like folks like me in these temperate climates can grow?
There is just, an endless list almost. And there's some great collections worldwide in the permaculture movement. It would be great, actually. We'd make those DVDs on a real budget, on the filming side of the budget. I literally knock them out in just a few days, one take each time almost, ad lib. We've talked about, it would be great to be funded to go to other climates around the world and make the DVD in relation to each different climate. We have a whole list of how-to DVDs we'd like to do now where we're a little bit more hands-on how-to. The crop you're talking about is the salad mallow has many names in the common names. It's a Cocorus genus. It's Cocorus oleotorus, and it's related to okra. So it's very similar to your okra, which is famous in the southern states of America. And you can eat the pod like okra when it's very small. And it's from the Middle East. It was a food of the pharaohs. And it hasn't been heavily domesticated, so it's very, very strong from the seed. And as soon as temperature comes right, dormant seeds lying around just take off. Just take off. I wrote very, very easy to grow. And the highest green leaf potassium in the world, which is an unusual sort of element. Potassium is sometimes a little bit hard to get hold of in the compost and in your food, and that's a great storer. The other one that we grow that's interesting is the hullless pumpkin, which grows the green seed. You don't eat the meat of the pumpkin, but you eat the green seed, and it comes, you can put it into your cereal, and it's you don't have to prepare it, you just dry it out of the pumpkin. Austrian hullless pumpkin. It's the highest food in vitamin E, another great accumulator of an element that's very valuable.
I just want to be clear on that because I'm gonna find a source for this and put a link in the show notes today. But you said wholeness, as in the absence of a hole, right?
Yeah. You eat green pepita seed.
Awesome. I'm gonna
send you through links to those elements, and then. Another one that we're growing now, we've just actually planted our winter crop here, is Ethiopian cabbage. It's a cabbage that's an open cabbage, a tall stick cabbage. It doesn't go into a ball, but the leaves taste exactly like cabbage. And it's a very, very strong, true strain cabbage that is unstoppable. I mean, it's just it's the hardiest brassica cabbage broccoli family that, you know, cauliflower family, the brassicas. It's the hardest brassica I've ever grown in my life. I got it from Michel Phantom of Seed Savers here about 8 years ago. And I have kilos and kilos of seed. It's easy to grow on from seed, and it's just, I don't know why you'd bother too much on a larger area growing any other brassica. It's just literally the easiest brassica I've ever seen.
And the flavor of that, is it similar to head cabbage or more like kale, or what's the flavor of that plant?
Well, we have chefs here that work at the Institute, and they're saying that there's hardly a difference between it and cabbage. Might be slightly towards the kale, but not much.
Okay.
It's more or less a cabbage. Another one we're growing here, and we're actually using it as a pioneer in food forests when we start up food forest systems. We do broad food forests here where we graze cows in a cell grazing system that is a polycultural cell grazing interaction that I have to write about because I think it's the best, it's one of the best little innovations that I personally have come up with. It's an electric, solar powered electric laneway on steel wire with moldable electric tape gates that I can lead cows along the laneway, which they get used to, and then out on these cell gates. And I have a complete flexibility about the mobile treading fence posts and electric tape that I set the cell off on. So I have complete flexibility outside of the laneway. I've about 2 miles of laneway and about 47 gates. And I have a variability of over 100 cells, but I can vary their size. So I graze an area, I clean up what the cows haven't eaten, and then about 30 to 50 days later, I graze it again. And then I'll clean up the area that bit more. They've manured it, they've carbon footprinted it. And then I put in an electric net run on the solar system to hold chickens. And I put 150 square meters with about 35 chickens. And about 10 days to 2 weeks later, they've cleared that land out, almost bare soiled it. I give it one rotary hoe and then put a cover crop in, and I'm into a food forest, 150 square meters at a time. So we're chunking our way across country, reforesting either as food forest or whatever sort of forest. But I put in a lot of pioneer trees and I put in a lot of pioneer plants and a lot of cover crop. And we accidentally included chia, which is this famous energy food grain that the Incas were famous for producing to get high energy to do their running and things. And we seem to have hit something that in this area works as a wonderful pioneer but high value food, and it's functioning as a crop accidentally for us. We're pioneering grand to food forest, but we're actually producing a very valuable grain. And when you offer people chia who are into health food, it's almost like you're offering a bag of drugs or something. They jump on you. How much is that?
It makes me think of the stupid old thing they used to have called the chia pet. I don't know if they ever had those over your way, but it was like this. It looked like a sheep made out of clay, and you pasted these chia seeds on it, and it grew like sprouts. And but you found this stuff is just going wild for you on your property.
Yeah, well, we've got quite a few of my students in this area have developed nice big examples of large permaculture swale dam productive systems, and we share it stuff when it happens. So we threw it out there to a few people, and they've all found the same thing. We've got a pioneer carbon stacker that'll get you up into food forest and give you a product that's worth many, many, many dollars per kilo. I mean, it's a very, very expensive crop. And when we put it onto our website, again, I wrote an article about it and said we had seed for sale. And it's quite a long time ago that that article was on our website. We still get hits. We still get people emailing us and saying, you know, have you got any of that chia seed for sale? Because it has such a reputation. That's interesting.
I could real quick ask you about the work you're doing with cattle, because I have a large segment of my audience that seems to feel that there's no way we can do meat sustainably. And my response has always been, well, then we're screwed because we're made out of meat. So we have to make meat sustainable. But it sounds like you're doing very sustainable meat production.
Look, you can't grow vegetables sustainably without animals. I mean, there's no way that you can fertilize. I mean, you have to have an animal interaction. You're not going to do it all with leguminous plants. And there are no vegetarian foods out there that don't have an animal manure interaction somewhere along the line. It's just not reasonable to think that way. There's a wonderful article again on our podcast on our website from Evan Young talking about this in detail. But we're the hardest workers on this farm are the beef cows. Second to those are the dairy cows. And beef cows do the rough work, and they improve country at a rate that we would never ever be able to achieve. I arrogantly thought that a few of us working hard with hand tools would pioneer forests and get in and recover landscape out of the weed species into quality forest. But no, the cows do it so much better. They are the best reforesters, and cattlemen will be the future foresters of the earth, and they'll create more forests than anybody. And we need to make that clear for people, and just very obvious common sense. They naturally do it. They just need management, and a lot of that is not just the physical management, but it's the timing management as well. Kevin, excuse my two-year-old trying to.
No, play. It's cool hearing your little one going on back there. Don't apologize for it at all. That's awesome.
I'm very fond of that. I couldn't live without my animals. I would feel rather strange. And they set the timing of everything. So some people say to us, oh, you know, you've got dairy cows. Well, it's like a prison sentence. I think it's quite the opposite. It's like saying that about children. I mean, you know, children can seem like, you know, they take all your time, or they give you all the pleasure. So it's just a matter of that relationship. You're in a relationship with the living elements of Earth. And there is nothing that can't be turned into a positive. I reforest with goats, and that shocks people. And it's just a matter of penning up the goats and feeding them the weed trees and relieving the forest of the weed trees. We have privet and other weed trees that the goats eat. We don't give them the choice of how or when they browse through the regrowth forest. We take the cut forest to them. The forest opens up. The legume trees come in that have been stripped out by grazing animals, but we don't allow into those areas anymore, and good trees can then be interplanted. So it's literally the goats give us the incentive to cut, otherwise we wouldn't have the incentive. This is where the economics come in. I could never afford to cut all the weed trees that I cut for the goats, only that I milk goats and I get goat meat from their offspring. So I'm getting meat, I'm getting manure, I'm getting milk, I'm getting the purpose to cut the weed trees to allow the good trees to come back. It's that understanding of relationships, and I think we'll probably get it with animals before people, and hopefully it will lead us to ourselves.
awesome stuff. It also makes me think of one of the things I remember hearing Bill say one time was there's no such thing as vegetarians, only repressed carnivores.
Yeah, we're just not thinking our way down the food chain. It's not a pyramid, really. It's not a top-down system. There's nothing out there that's particularly top-down. It's all a complex life web matrix. When we engage in that and think that way, we can speed up that matrix. We can make that matrix a lot more exciting. And, of course, in that productive and permanent and stable.
Do you have any suggestions? The one thing I always see, every time I see you talk about building a dam, you're always in the subtropics, and then there's always this place where the water comes out, and then there's a banana circle. And every time I see you build a banana circle, I'm like, dang it, I can't plant bananas. Using that same system, do you have like a temperate climate planting guild that would work in that type of an arrangement?
It's a common question and a difficult one to answer because it's the lack of branches on the stem of the banana and also the papaya and the palms. Now, there are not many fruiting palms outside of the subtropics to tropics, actually, but there is one that goes to quite cool, and that's the peach palm or jelly palm or wine palm. Okay. It's called Butea capitata. Now that may stretch further than papaya and banana. Outside of that, I think we need to probably look at systems that are different in yield. We may have to think out of the box a little bit. Now, what you can do is you can put in a willow circle and turn it into a coppiced willow production. Awesome. So you're producing carbon. Now, the Salix is the willow genus, and there's over 100. And there are some that have very high value. There are the basket willows, of course, and then there are the pencil willows, which if you charcoal those, you get quite a good price per artist pencils once they're charcoaled. Now, a willow doesn't have tap roots, and a banana circle is very valuable as a receiver of surplus nutrient. So we've just been working with interns here, and we put in one at the end of a reed bed grey water soakage trench. So we have a reed bed after a septic, and then we have underground soaking trenches that have like a leach field. So the banana circle will suck out extra nutrient there. But we've also just put one around a duck pen. We have a surplus amount of ducks and a little duck pond that overflows. We've put a gravel trench that picks up that nutrient and ends up in a banana circle. It was a little design exercise. So what we call a nutrient-rich gravel trench leading to a banana circle. Now, that same sort of nutrient soakage trench, that nutrient direction, could be directed to a willow circle, and you could simply turn it into bulk biomass, even if you were just using that as mulch. Willows are a wonderful converter of leaching nutrient into stable, slow to break down carbon mulch. So you can do exchanges. What we're doing is we're setting up wonderful sort of miracles of exchange. We're using the living system as the exchange media.
That's an incredible answer, Jeff, because I've been looking for a good answer to that one for a long time. And I think, yeah, willow has a tremendous number of uses, and it would fit into the system. So I've struggled with that one, so thanks for that answer, man. A lot like you have, maybe in different capacity, because I was in the military during this time, I spent quite a bit of time in what I would consider like the third world, and I know you've done a tremendous amount of work in third world nations, and I think that maybe lights kind of a fire of, hey, there's a lot to be done, and there's a lot at risk. But one of the things that I noticed when I was in places like Honduras was the poverty people lived in, but their ability to kind of rise above it and live really good quality lives. But where things were really bad were actually like some of the, instead of out in the countryside, it was more close to the cities where people would kind of lose hope. And I was wondering if maybe just based on your experiences with that part of the world, if you've noticed, you know, similar things, that it's when people lose hope, that's when things get really bad. But as long as we can give them something to look forward to tomorrow, we can kind of fix things.
Yeah. Their movement from traditional systems where there are processes and protocols that are set in to check and balance the emotions that are inevitable in life, they're lost once you move towards the aspiration of modern life and modern systems, and you lose your time quality and time density. That sort of degrades away into this treadmill type existence where you're rushing, and you haven't got time to think, and then you get into a hopelessness. And that has gradually crept up on the Western developed world, and it's like we haven't sort of necessarily sensed it coming, and we've just sort of slowly dumbed down to this system that seems like it's the norm and almost inevitable, where in the developing world, it's been a much faster transition. In fact, it's still happening at a faster and faster rate. So the speed of degradation of lifestyle is rapid. So people literally move from a traditional system where everything is nicely set up as far as handling catastrophes or strong emotional events with quite detailed and lengthy processes and protocols, all of a sudden into this automatic acceptance that, you know, everything can be gone in a second, and you know, you're either on or you're off, and you either make it or you don't make it, and you know, we'll compromise however we like just to, you know, maybe make that, you know, big hit, you know, maybe make that sort of jump into wealth and everything we aspire to be instantly. We're in this instant gratification world, and in the first world now, our kids are turning into screenagers, where they're just in front of a screen more than half their day, more than half their and reality is something accepted through a screen. No, you can't really sense it in half of your senses are not switched on. It's only your keyboard finger and nothing else, and you there's nothing to smell, there's nothing to touch, and you're hearing, you know, electronic and seeing electronic digital imagery, and that's kind of psychologically strange. So we're moving in strange directions here, and it doesn't take much to get people seeing a little bit of common sense and linking to their wisdom of traditional processes and protocols. It's a sentimental thing in the developed world, in the Western world. In the developing world, there is still some reasonably quick links back to it. So there are some real challenges, and there's lessons everywhere, I think. The future is probably not something we can imagine exactly in the positive, but it is so possible. I think we have a lot to learn from and people that still have those connections, and of course they have a lot to learn from us too. It's a sharing thing, but my concern very much is for just the innocence of the children who weren't asked to be born into these situations, and that I find upsetting when there are so many complications out there. The world gets more and more complicated in its problems all the time, but the solutions to the world remain ironically simple, and that is rather frustrating. I've seen too many children simply dying of cholera because no one's explained how to make a functional compost toilet. I can't believe that hasn't been extended out more than what it has. And everywhere I go, I try and help people where children are dying unnecessarily, because that, you know, there's a population issue, and wealth tends to moderate population, And when we redefine wealth as not meaning just money, but, you know, clean air and clean food and clean water and sensible housing, warmth, friendship and community, if that's more of a definition of wealth, we can also moderate the population of the earth simply by behaving in a way that's beneficial to the earth. And we need, you know, need kids to realize there's something a little bit beyond what we call wealth at the moment, which is just some kind of strange money exchange.
Yeah, I think we've gotten lost in that heavily, and one of the big things that I try to teach people is to let go of that, the stuff lifestyle. And I'm not saying not to have some nice things. I have some nice things, I'm sure you do too, but how much of that stuff do we really need, and what really gives you a sense of meaning and purpose? I know that when I was still in the corporate world, I would come home, and I'd go out to the garden, and I'd water it even if it didn't need watering, just because after an hour of being on the highway, that's what I needed to unplug, not the television set, you know, or things like that. I needed to kind of connect.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, of course, we're talking to each other on a technology here that is an advantage.
Absolutely.
That's, you know, and yet we've got to balance out what it is that's appropriate. And there's, you know, we have wonderful achievements of technology and what it is that is not necessarily appropriate. And mostly it's our approach to the technology and our exploitation of people through the technology, rather than, you know, a creative result. So we've got to look at those creative results. Once the economy drives the environment and we have gauges for the environment, as in, you know, the water's getting cleaner, the air's getting cleaner, biological diversity's increasing, soil fertility is continuously increasing, soil volumes are increasing rather than depleting. Then we have, then all our economy is beneficial to the earth. And that's that green ecology, that's that financial ecology, that's that financial, economy. That we need to create. So that's a different way of looking at the system.
Yeah, that's a great lead up to one of the last questions I wanted to ask you today, which is, do you think that we can take permaculture principles and apply them to things outside of agriculture, like to running a business? And I don't mean in this instance anyway, you know, a business with a large campus growing food. I mean the actual operations of the business independent of agriculture, such as, you know, the 12 design principles. Can they actually be taken over and be used to design a business or a school from kind of a logistics standpoint?
Yes. Yeah, I think that is being done. Because permaculture is in many schools. There are 9 charter schools in Detroit right now running permaculture programs. But the corporate world has caught up with permaculture. People talk about, you know, it would be great if permaculture was in the mainstream. It was great if permaculture was part of the mainstream. I think what's happened is that permaculture is the mainstream, and it's just caught up with us. And really, it's actually, you know, permaculture has been like this wonderful lush island that's worth landing on, and the mainstream's been sort of circling the coast for a while, trying to figure out where they're going to do the beach landing safely, and that's starting to happen very much. I was involved in a design team that took on that got the contract to design the landscape for Masdar City in the United Arab Emirates, which is a massive project to design in a carbon neutral city. And as part of that design team, I was very pleasantly surprised to realize that once I'd gone through the introduction to all the experts on the team, They were able to communicate with me in every variation of their expertise. Every expert could communicate in relation to permaculture and in the design of the landscape, and they felt that it was central to the theme of the design of the new city. that permaculture was the new mainstream system, and they said they were just waiting for this to happen. And I realized that we'd been sort of developing all the time as a central element to future mainstream thinking. And I thought we don't have to catch up. It's the mainstream has to catch up with this way of thinking and approaching the world. It doesn't have to be named. It is the evolution of the way we will behave in the future. It's an evolution of human thinking, and it's where we take our responsibility. We're going through an adolescent stage where, you know, in adolescence you tend to try a lot of different things and you be a bit wild and you kind of, you know, run yourself down a bit and party all night and do a few things. And then eventually you sort of get over it and you become responsible. Mm. And you kind of like, then you start to really live the majority of your life in a more of a responsible state. I think that's the state of humanity on this planet. We've got to that. We're just at the end of adolescence. And we're about to take responsibility and start living the real life.
Awesome, awesome stuff, Jeff. How can people kind of help you, help the Institute, that type of thing? I mean, I know you're doing great work around the world. Are there ways that people can get involved and help out?
Yeah. It sure is. We have a lot of institutes that we're setting up and a lot of places that need help with funding, of course, because there's a lot of – I've got a young man here now, PRI Kenya. He's setting up Permaculture Research Institute Kenya. He's a young Maasai, African gentleman, and he took a course with me in Tanzania 6 years ago. He's gone ahead and proved himself, and I've funded him back here. There's things like that. We put a lot of money into our website just to showcase permaculture to the world. And, of course, that gives us a bit of connections and fills our courses. But we're setting up more and more institutes worldwide. But something we've done just recently at our own expense, it was just a return of surplus, is we set up permacultureglobal.com, which is it's called the Permaculture Worldwide Network. It's a connection website, and it's set up on a Facebook-type format. It's a Facebook, Twitter, Google Earth, Google Map database of permaculture globally. And you can see all the permaculture people of the world that have signed up and all the permaculture projects of the world on screen. You can fly in on Google Earth or Google Maps and get as close as you like. You can see the pin. Everybody gets a free web page, and you can see everybody's resume. You can search for teachers. You can search for projects. You can search for aid workers. You can search for consultants. You can search for in climate zone. You can pick a drylands or an Arctic or a tropical or a temperate climate consultant, project or designer or aid worker. All these things. We set this up. It wasn't a little bit of work. It was an enormous. And I'm an internet dinosaur, but I work with people. I try and work with good people who want to help out. That was a very expensive exercise, and we expected the permaculture world or people to help us with that and put their name on it. Only our name's on it at the moment. We'd say in the website, this is a gift to the permaculture world, but if you want to help sponsor it or anybody wants to help sponsor it, we can drive that's a foundation of a website that can be driven to something that is incredibly interactive. It's cost us an enormous amount of time and money to get it to where it is, and we're just hoping people will get on board and put their name up on the top and their organization name on it. We don't advertise much, but anybody wants to help us with that website, because if people come to you and say, what's this permaculture movement about? I mean, how big is it? Just direct them straight to permacultureglobal.com, because then you really see how big we are. You see, you cannot surf your way through that website in a week. It's enormous. Just have a surf through there. It's wonderful. There's so much going on globally. And that's the only website that's provided that service that you can see, oh, wow, this is not a little thing. This is a really big thing that's happening. And that hopefully will help us go towards that tipping point where we don't have to be in such a catastrophe.
Awesome. Well, hey, make sure you get your chip-in thing on there where people can donate, started with a new event or something, because I'm going to dump a bunch of people on that website for you when this show airs. And I'm going to ask right now that the audience do what they can to help you out with that. So make sure you have a button on there where people can do that, because the one you have on there currently is expired.
Okay, I can do that, and I'll send it through to Craig, our web manager.
Because, folks, definitely, I mean, we all talk about permaculture all the time on here. You guys are always looking for more information. I know the audience, you guys are really like a sponge with learning this stuff. But doing all this stuff takes a lot of work and takes a lot of effort. So if you guys could consider today chipping in and helping out Jeff and the Permaculture Institute, I'd appreciate it. And Jeff, thank you so much for being on the show today. It was a big honor for me to have you on the show. It's something I've been wanting to do for a long time.
All right, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure.
All right, folks, and with that, this has been Jack Spirico today along with Jeff Lawton, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. Sometimes we forget we are what we eat. I don't know the answer. It's like there's nothing I can do. It's the price we pay, I guess, when we follow all the rules. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. Revolution.